Welcome to what is technically the Baseball and Media Committee meeting. Although we'll be dispensing with the committee business appetizer, we're going to move right on to the main course, which is our panel. So let me.
I'm here to take minutes, actually.
Well, if you would please, I'd appreciate it. I don't have a pen. Hope you have one. So let's go ahead and introduce our guests. So Joe Castiglione began his professional career calling football games in Youngstown, Ohio. From there, Joe went to Cleveland in 1979 to call games for the NBA Cavaliers and the then-named Indians before moving on to Milwaukee to call a few Brewers games for the old pay channel Select TV in 1981. His career stabilized once he arrived in Boston, and he teamed with Ken Coleman to call games for Red Sox Radio starting in 1983. Joe eventually was named Red Sox lead radio announcer in 1992 and has held that post for the most part ever since. He was, of course, on hand for all four Red Sox rings during the past couple of decades, and his call of "Can You Believe It?" after the 2004 series win attained national catchphrase status. Last month, Joe was honored for his 40 years with the Bo Sox in a pregame ceremony, cementing his status as one of the game's all-time great broadcasters. Ladies and gentlemen, please give a warm welcome to Red Sox broadcaster and Sabre member, Joe Castiglione.
Thank you very much.
Now, unlike Mr. Castiglione, many of the accolades Kevin Brown will inevitably receive are yet to come. But make no mistake, they will come. A professional broadcaster since the age of 21, Kevin started his career calling games for the Syracuse Chiefs of the International League in 2011, holding the TV and radio play-by-play job for seven seasons. After a year off in the day-to-day grind of calling baseball games, Kevin landed in Baltimore to take on the Orioles radio job in 2019. After three seasons in that role, well, okay, more like 2.37 seasons, Kevin moved over to the Masson booth to beginning this season to take the TV play-by-play job. In addition to all the Major League Baseball he does, Kevin has also done broadcasting work for ESPN, calling football, college basketball, softball, and, of course, Little League Baseball, where he probably caught a Little League home run or two. Probably caught one or two of those in the big leagues as well. Kevin has decades of broadcasting, baseball broadcasting still in his future. All we have to do is stay alive long enough to enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, please put your hands together in a vigorous back and forth motion for Kevin Brown. Now, I'm very excited to have these two particular gentlemen on our panel because of the differences in background they have in terms of TV versus radio, minor leagues versus majors, number of years broadcasting, et cetera, et cetera. So we can get perspectives unique to each of them and their situation. So I guess starting at the beginning, starting with Joe, can you please tell us how you got into the business of baseball broadcasting? Like, how did the doors of the profession open up to you and land you your first job?
Well, like most broadcasters, a frustrated player. But fortunately, I knew at about age 10 I wasn't good enough to play. So I turned to the next best thing, would have fungal games in my backyard, and I was always the Yankees. We all learn from our mistakes, but I did grow up a Yankee fan. Mel Allen was my hero, and I always wanted to be a baseball broadcaster since, as I say, I knew I couldn't play. But, you know, the circuitous routes to get there, and my way to get there was TV anchor. I was anchoring sports in Youngstown, Ohio, Cleveland, Syracuse, and then finally I got a baseball job. I never did minor league baseball. My first job was with the Cleveland Indians in 1979, and we did 40 games in those days. There was no cable TV in 79, and they weren't going to preempt CBS primetime programming for a sixth-place team. So we did those games, and it was a start. Then our station lost the contract, so I did Milwaukee games, came back to Cleveland when we started a regional sports channel, and my partner was Bob Feller. I had heard all the stories. Bob is not exactly politically correct, but a great guy. He was wonderful. He played catch with my kids. He came to their birthday parties. We had a wonderful time together, and we remained friends for the rest of Bob's life. And in 1983, John Miller left the Red Sox radio booth to come here to Baltimore, and I happened to be working with Ken Coleman's son, Casey, the late Casey Coleman in Cleveland, and he told his dad about me, and the next thing I knew I had the job, and with the Red Sox, back to New England. My roots, I'm from New Haven, Connecticut, and I've been there ever since. No one ever expects to be in a job, let alone a broadcasting job, for 40 years, but I've had many blessings. I've had great partners, and I've had the support of the ball club, which is the most important thing. We don't work for the ball club. We work for Odyssey Broadcasting. They pay us, but, of course, the ball club decides who does the games. But both ownership groups, the Yawkey Group with John Harrington and Haywood Sullivan, and the John Henry Group have been very supportive of me, and you need that to last that long. So it's something I've always wanted to do. I still love doing it, and still do about 140 games. I don't know how long I'll keep doing that many at my advanced age, but it's still a lot of fun.
Joe, did you ever really want to get into TV?
Oh, I did TV when I started with Cleveland. And the reason I wanted to do radio is because we only did 40 games in those days before cable, and you know, it wasn't a full-time job. But right now I got a better face for radio. So, you know, they don't like to see gray hair on TV.
Kevin, how about you?
Everything Joe said applies to me as well. Bob Feller and I were also very close. No, this is not going to be quite as long of a story. It starts when I was a kid, which was like a week ago. But I grew up on Long Island. I didn't know if I could admit this here, but since you did and you work for the Red Sox, I can also admit I grew up a Yankee fan. Grew up was past tense. Again, we learn from our mistakes. I guess the first time I ever called a game, I was 8 or 9. I was at my PAL league's basketball all-star game, which I was not in because I had scored 0 career points, but my dad was the coach, so I had to go. So he said, you know, just bring your T-shirt in case somebody doesn't show up. You can play. And I said, why would anyone want me to play? I've scored 0 points, and no one was absent. So I sat on the stage and just, I don't know why. I was a weird kid. Probably many of us who were in broadcasting were weird kids and are now weird adults. I just called the whole game to myself, and then the couple next to me, who must have been perturbed because they had to sit through this chattering 9-year-old imbecile talk about number 12 to number 9, over to number 7 for you know, 4 quarters. They said, good job, Marv. And that was it. That's all I needed to hear. I was ready. So, yeah, like every other young white male play-by-play broadcaster in the industry, went to Syracuse University. And as Chuck said, did 7 years there in AAA. I was very, very, very fortunate to be hired by Jason Benetti, who many of you know is voice of the White Sox, now at Fox Sports. I think I see a Chicago hat right there, in fact. Jason is a genius. The smartest person I know, in or out of the industry. And, I just got to learn from him for 4 years how he handled himself on and off the air. And that was, you know, a lot of us don't necessarily go to graduate school for broadcasting, but that was my graduate school, 4 years with him. So he left, I took over the lead position for him, and then just a stroke of good luck, I, as Joe, as you know, like, we have to be good, but also have to be luckier than good.
Right place at the right time.
So the Syracuse Chiefs at the time, they're now the Mets affiliate, were the Nationals affiliate. In 2017, Charlie Sloes, who's the Nationals radio broadcaster, his son graduated high school, and they needed to fill in for a couple of days, and I filled in for a couple of days. And so Masson runs both the Nationals and Orioles broadcasts, and I got to know a couple of people there at Masson just from filling in, and then 2019 this came opened, and I had just done some work with the company. There was some knowledge of me, and again, right place, right time, and here we are now.
One Baltimore connection. I went to Colgate University, and we didn't have any broadcasting courses. I later did a master's at Syracuse, but I'm more proud of my Colgate background.
We still claim you, though.
You can claim me, yeah. I worked when I was there. That was a big thing. I worked at Channel 3, did the cut-ins, and Today Show news and all that, and DJ everything for $2.25 an hour as a grad student. But it was a lot of fun. But anyway, Colgate, I was a freshman. I was doing the basketball and the football games. And in 1965, we had a home-and-home series with Syracuse. Syracuse beat us 60 straight times up until this year. Colgate finally turned the tables. But Colgate was hosting Syracuse. They had Dave Bing, I still think the greatest player in Syracuse history. And we took them a triple overtime in our tiny little gym. We eventually lost. But on the way out, I accidentally picked up a gentleman's gloves. It was the gloves of the Syracuse broadcaster, Bill O'Donnell. And that's how we met, and we became good friends. He was a mentor to me. Every time that he heard of a job, he would call me, let me know, and we stayed in touch over the years. He came to Baltimore in 1966, great timing, when, of course, the Orioles won their first world championship, and worked with Chuck Tanner, or with Chuck Thompson. I worked with Chuck Tanner in Youngstown, but he worked with Chuck Thompson for so many years until Bill passed away from cancer, I believe in 1982. But he was a mentor to me and was so good to me, and we stayed in touch right until his passing. And I would, when I was in Cleveland doing TV, I would keep the scoreboard for Bill and Chuck in their booth, and it really taught me about teamwork and how two partners like that could be so close and such great friends, and stayed very close with Chuck Thompson the rest of his life, a wonderful guy. Sometimes we go to St. Leo's in Little Italy here, and they had a funny priest there, a guy from Brooklyn. He says, I don't know nothing about baseball, but I know Chuck Thompson got me this roof. He had a fundraiser. He got a new roof at the church. But he was a wonderful guy, and he was probably 70, 80 years old, and he still sounded like he was 30. And so you have a great broadcasting tradition here, especially with those two.
Yeah. So, Kevin, kind of following up on what you said earlier, as a 9-year-old doing basketball play-by-play in front of other people and getting feedback on it, when did you first determine that you were going to make baseball broadcasting your career? When did you know you were going to pursue it seriously? I mean, were you a child, or was it later on, college?
Yeah, I mean, I went to college thinking I would do something in sports media, probably. I didn't know if that was play-by-play or studio work or newspaper journalism. So I tried everything. I wrote for the Daily Orange, which is the wonderful student newspaper at Syracuse. I had one byline. I turned in a piece on a field hockey player. The editor said they didn't like it. I said, okay, that's enough for me. I don't take criticism well. I was on the sports talk radio staff, too. I'm not a compelling talk show host because I don't have enough opinions. The great sports talk radio hosts, like I'm from Long Island, Mike and the Mad Dog, Mike would say the sky is blue. Dog would say, Mike, the sky is purple. You're an idiot. Then they could do 2 hours on the color of the sky. I see both sides of things too well. So my talk radio shows were never good because my opinion was, well, maybe the manager's an idiot, but maybe he knows what he's doing. not compelling. So, yeah, I just started going to games, making tapes. There's a wonderful student radio station at Syracuse where you can go out and call the university football games and basketball games and lacrosse games. And I just fell in love with the art of live sports, but there's no Syracuse baseball team. So my first baseball experience was actually in Alaska. There is a summer baseball league in Alaska, the Alaska Baseball League, which is one of the great college leagues in the world. And I had an internship there for 2 months, went to Alaska, had probably been on a plane like 3 times in my life, went all the way to Alaska, and just called baseball for 2 months, and that was it. I was in love.
Yeah, and that was going to be your profession then. That's when you knew. Joe, when did you decide that you were going to be pursuing baseball as a profession?
Well, probably about age 10.
Yeah,
I always wanted to do it, and Mel Allen was my hero growing up. I think the greatest broadcaster, along with Vince Scully and Ernie Harwell. And you take whatever route you can to get there, and I had to do it all. I mean, I was a disc jockey playing the hits and the Red News, and I had to sell at one job, which I absolutely hated. so that I could do sports. And, you know, you try to move up the ladder, make contacts, like I mentioned with Bill O'Donnell and with Ken Coleman's son, and eventually sometimes it happens. For many, it doesn't. You have to be in the right place at the right time. And fortunately, I had a lot of people that helped me along the way.
Yeah, great. So how do you prep for your game on a day-to-day basis? Like, when do you arrive at the ballpark? What are some of the things you do when you get there leading up to game time, Joe?
Well, I really think you prepare in baseball for a lifetime. I've done football and basketball. The action can carry it. As we know, that little thing that's 5 1/4 ounces with 108 stitches is probably in play only about 8 minutes out of 3 hours. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of dead time. You really have to know the game inside and out, and you have to know the history of the game. You have to know the rules and the history, because everything that happened today in baseball builds on what happened yesterday and the day before and the year before and the decade before and now the century before. Unlike other sports where the rules have changed, the size of the players changing dramatically, baseball builds on what happened before, like a pyramid. So I think you have to have that background and know the game thoroughly. And you can't fool a baseball fan. I mean, you can fool football people with jargon and technical terms and X and O's. But baseball, you can't fool anybody, because even though fans may think they know it all, they may not, but they think they do, and that's all that really matters. So you really have to know the game inside and out. But generally what I do is when I'm on the road, when I get up, I read the I used to read the newspapers. Now I don't think they exist very far anymore. You can't even find them in hotels. But we read the internet, the hometown papers, if they don't charge you for them, as many do. I couldn't get the Baltimore Sun today. You have to subscribe.
Do you want that password?
Yeah. But I do read the Globe, and, you know, read ESPN.com, MLB.com. And people send me things. You try to get as much background information as you can. When we're at home, I usually get to the ballpark about 3:30 for a 7 o'clock game. The first thing we do every other day, we do the manager's show, usually around 3:30, between 3:30 and 4 o'clock. I alternate with my partner, Will Fleming, so we can get there later on the second day when we're not doing the game, because he's doing it today. That's how I can be here. But in any event, then we go to batting practice, try to hang out in the dugout, around the cage. Just that's the time to listen. That's the time to learn, to pick up stories, not necessarily breaking news, but human interest background stories on players, just to chit-chat and to try to get some background information. Then, you know, we go do the lineup card, fill that out, read the notes, stay on the internet. And I always like to go to the media dining room and sit with the scouts, because I learned so much from the scouts from other teams. Unfortunately, since COVID, scouts are barely traveling. Some organizations have replaced scouts, which I think is very unfortunate, and we don't quite have that resource anymore, except in a couple of places. But very, very seldom do you have the chance to mingle with scouts from other teams anymore. And then, you know, the game starts, and you hope the action carries itself. It doesn't always happen. You know, I think Dave O'Brien, our TV guy, tells me that I lead all time in four-hour games. I've done more four-hour baseball games than anyone in history. And I think that's true, given the time period in which I've worked. And that's why we desperately need a pitch clock.
And we will get it, I'm sure of it. Kevin, what does your day-to-day look like?
Not too dissimilar. 7 o'clock game usually at the park around 3:30 range. Our clubhouse typically opens around 3:10, so try to pop into the clubhouse. Try to at least get, even if it's 20-30 seconds with a couple of players. Tomorrow I have to get in there because I'm not here today, but also Jordan Lyles is pitching today, so. Tradition dictates you typically wouldn't speak to the starting pitcher on the day of his start. But Jordan threw a cutter all year for the first time last time out, so I asked our pitching coach a little about that beforehand. I'd like to find out from Jordan tomorrow why he introduced that. Simple things like that, just to try to pick up a piece of information or two that might not be intuitive. I am pretty anal about my scorebook, too. I use the Bob Carpenter scorebook, which I'm sure some people in here do. I see some nodding heads. Bob, who does the TV for the Nationals, his scorebook is like the gospel to me. It has not only lines for all the players, it has a little defensive outline of the ball field to put where the defenders are. It has all these little nooks and crannies for things, so I try to write down as much as I can in that, A, because I just want to have that in front of me in a digestible place rather than all these papers, and B, because if I write things down, it just helps my brain a little more. So I'll write in the lineups, I'll write just the age next to the player and whether they're righty or lefty. So Cedric Mullins, I'll be 27L, so that way if I look down the lineup, I can quickly see LRS. Hey, there are six lefties in the lineup today. Try to write down the pitcher stats, bullpen, days of rest in the bullpen. I will put in the team stats, offensively runs per game, and then just the league ranks for average on-base slugging, home runs, steals, ERA. I didn't do a lot of writing in the standings the last 3 years because we didn't want to talk about the standings the last 3 years. And the Orioles are 76 games out. This year I make sure I have the wild card standings updated every day.
That's right.
They're ahead of us.
Yeah. We are. That's right. Let's keep it that way. Let's hope. So, yeah, I try to just write as much as possible. I probably overdo it to a fault. But one thing out of the dozens and dozens of things I write in my scorebook will pop up or will strike to a conversation with Jim Palmer or Ben McDonald. And I always have this fear that if I miss the one thing, you know, if I didn't write down that, you know, Cedric Mullins hadn't committed an error in 186 games, day's going to be the day he's going to commit the error and I'm going to be scrambling. How many games is it? So I probably overdo it, but I try to write down as much as possible. Black pen, blue pen. It probably looks to the uninitiated like the scribblings of the Zodiac Killer or something, but we all have our systems. Like, every one of us has a weird scorebook system that works, and I'll keep track of pitches throughout the game with little check marks and X's and O's. And yeah, I'm constantly tweaking it, but it works for me right now.
You do a hard hit, soft hit balls and that kind of thing as well?
I will, if a ball's hit particularly hard, I'll just, in a blue pen, just write down the exit velo next to it.
Oh.
So here's Santander, who hit a ball 111 miles an hour last time.
Sure.
I'll just write nice or wow if there's a good defensive play, which is very crude. But
I used to keep
4-3, wow.
I used to keep a file card on every player in the league and write down anecdotes and interesting stats that I might use. I don't do that anymore because I've been around a while. It's a lot of work. But I use the Herb Score card. Herb Score. He did radio and I was doing TV in Cleveland. He was a great guy. Poor guy probably saw more losing games than anybody in broadcast history with bad Indians teams that didn't go to postseason from 1955 through 1994. They finally got there in 95. And Herb's very last game was game 7 of the 97 World Series. And he leaned over to his partner, Tom Hamill, and said, "This is my last game. I'm retiring." And Indians lose in 11 innings on the walk-off hit by Edgar Renteria. And that was Herb's the end of his career after all those losing games. But he had the Herb Score card, similar to the Carpenter card, and I still use it today, although I shortened it, made it smaller because it was too heavy to carry.
I made a joke earlier about Kevin moving to TV after 2.37 seasons. You know, I'm obviously referring to the truncated 2020 COVID season. You know, and all the weirdness that is, you know, that ensued for everybody and everything that we did, and baseball broadcasters obviously not spared in that. So, can each of you tell us a little bit about how you experienced that season? How it affected your broadcast, having to do them remotely? How it changed your prep work, the technical aspects of doing games? Just anything you can share about how that affected you and affected maybe even your current approach to the job, or did everything just kind of unexpectedly go back 100% to the way they were before? Like, how are things different, Kevin?
I would say it's pretty much normal again for me. The biggest difference was just we couldn't be down at the batting cage. We couldn't be in the clubhouse. We lost the personal touch of being around people and just learning from osmosis what you learn on the bus or somebody walking down the aisle on a plane on a road trip. I think I probably ended up, on the few TV games I did that you're talking a little more because right now with the crowds back and particularly for home games, big play happens, you can just shut up and let the crowd take it. Mm-hmm. And in 2020, this is more technical, I guess, than prep-wise, but if somebody hit a big home run and I just shut up, you wouldn't really hear anything. You hear fake crowd noise. Let's move the slider up on the fake crowd. So, I don't know. I think subconsciously, this was the same for you. I think I just talked more because I felt like there was more dead space and I tried to fill it. Mm.
Yes, I reverted back to my youth when I used to turn down the sound on TV and do the play-by-play to myself. And that's pretty much how we handled it. You were restricted. We had a big monitor. We had a couple of smaller monitors. Sometimes you could see who was warming up at the bullpen. Sometimes you could see where the defense was stationed. A lot of times you couldn't. The toughest thing was, is that replay or is that happening live? And I know a couple of broadcasters, and I almost did this too, who called a home run a second time when it was the replay. Because there's no noise. There's no crowd. I mean, the fake crowd noise. But it was very challenging. We would work in Fenway Park, and there were five of us for the road games, five of us in the ballpark at night, especially when the team was playing on the West Coast. Myself, my broadcast partner, our engineer, and two Spanish announcers. That was it. And there was a security guard. And I didn't feel all that secure because she was about 75 years old, about that high. And anyone could have come into the ballpark. it was unique. But you got used to not traveling. And I always enjoy the travel in the cities. But you also get spoiled because you're not doing all-nighters like we did last night or on the way to Pittsburgh the other day. And it becomes more of a routine. But it wasn't nearly as much fun not having the personal contact.
Yeah, so Joe, you were a Red Sox broadcaster in 1986, so you must have your own interesting perspective on the Bill Buckner play. So I just wanted to see, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you experienced that. My understanding is that you were in the clubhouse waiting to cover the celebration.
Right.
So what were some of the things that were going on at that time?
Well, I was working with Ken Coleman. I did the top of the 10th inning when Dave Henderson hit the Newsday sign and left for a home run. And then Marty Barrett drove in Boggs, who doubled, had a two-run lead. So in the commercial break, I said to Ken, do you want me to go to the clubhouse or do you want me to finish in the bottom of the 10th inning? And he said, it's strictly up to you. Well, I thought after 20 years, he deserved to call the last out of the World Championship. And besides, I wanted to be down there and get soaked with champagne. And Shea Stadium was a horrible ballpark. It was archaic. One tiny little elevator. So I had to run down the ramps to get down to the clubhouse. By the time I got down there, two out and nobody on. And I'm standing outside the clubhouse. They bring Mrs. Yawkey and Lou Gorman in. They bring the champagne in. The door opens. I see the cellophane covering over the lockers so that the personal belongings don't get soaked. And then there's a delay, and I moved over. A security guard had a little transistor radio, and I hear bass hit, bass hit. And then I hear Bob Murphy say, gets away, and here comes the tying run, which was the biggest play in that series, much bigger than the Buckner ball, because that tied the game. It was scored a wild pitch. It could have been a pass ball. But it tied the game. We already had blown the lead. And the game was tied, so I started to run up the ramps back to the booth for the 11th inning, and I heard the crowd. I knew it ended. I didn't know how until SportsCenter that night at 2 a.m. When the ball went through Buckner's leg. So I was spared, in a manner of speaking. I thought, it was my fourth year. I didn't feel devastated because, first of all, we should have lost to the Angels. They had a 3-1 lead, and Dave Henderson hit the big home run, and we come from behind down 3-1 to beat them. But I figured we'll be back next year, the year after. It took 18 years to get back to the World Series.
But come back you did.
Please don't ask me about where I was during the Buckner play, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let me.
Next question.
Get rid of that one.
You weren't.
Okay. Next question for Kevin. So you've recently been a regular broadcaster in the minors. Mm-hmm. So being a play-by-play chief, play-by-play guy for the Chiefs for 7 years. So you probably have a pretty good handle on how the day routine of calling a AAA game differed from that of calling a major league game. So can you kind of tell us a little bit what some of those differences are, maybe even what some of the surprising similarities are?
I'll start by saying it's much easier, much, much easier, because now we show up around 3:30. You do your prep work in the morning too, but with the minors, for a lot of teams at the time and a lot of teams still, there's no PR department. You're the PR department. You handle the media relations. You compile the game notes. You print the game notes. You print the stat packs. You set up any interview requests. Occasionally, you pull the tarp. I didn't have to do it much, but many others did. So I would show up at noon often. My first year, I would show up at 11, and there would be 11 to 11 days sometimes. Yeah. Because you just had to do all this tedium, and you didn't know what project your general manager might have for you that day. So there were days in the minors where we'd sit down for the pregame show at 6:30, and occasionally in Syracuse, there'd be a buzz, right? We had Bryce Harper for a month my second year there. We had some Steven Strasburg rehab appearances, Ryan Zimmerman. Some of the better nationals came through. And those days were the days where the local media would really come out, and your day would be all about coordinating with the player, with the manager, with the local media. And at 6:30, you'd sit down and you go, I have nothing in my scorebook. So now I get to the ballpark and I can have the scorebook basically done. It's just a lot simpler. There's so much more information. AAA is easier. I was very lucky in that I got to start in AAA. I didn't have to do what a lot of broadcasters do, which is start in the Carolina League or, in the Southern League or Appalachian League or whatever. Most of the players I was covering in AAA either had been in the majors or were going. Mm-hmm. So you had a sense of who some of them were. But there's just less information available. There was one beat writer in Syracuse, and he basically stopped showing up in 2013 outside of once a month just to really piss off the manager once a month. And that was it. You had to do all of your own research, really. You couldn't rely on, ESPN wasn't writing stories about Syracuse Chiefs or The Athletic or MLB.com. So it's a lot easier now, which can be a crutch. There are some good things about being in the minors and forcing yourself to get to do more long-form interviews and getting to know players a little bit more. Sure. But it's a give and take. There are great ways to use that time now as well.
Good. So, Joe, you were lucky enough not only to be there when the Red Sox finally broke the curse of the Bambino, but you were instrumental in the experience for other people, Red Sox fans, who experienced it through your eyes and your voice. So can you tell us a little bit about that final inning in 2004, the atmosphere, your feelings, how you experienced them in the moment, and how you felt you needed to convey that to people?
Well, I dreamed about it for a long time, thought about it. What would I say? How would I call the final play? And we were in St. Louis, the Busch Stadium 2, and I went in the middle of the seventh inning to change into my champagne clothes because I thought we were going to win. I should, could have jinxed it, I guess, but we had 3-0. And anyway, my partner at the time, Jerry Trupiano, went down to the clubhouse, and I was alone in the booth, and I think I was just in a zone. I decided I can't script what I'm going to say. I don't know how it's going to end. All I was hoping was that it would be a definitive play, not a check swing. Did he swing or didn't he? Diving catch. Did he catch it or didn't he? Or, it didn't have replay at the time, but that would have been even worse. I was just hoping for something very simple to end it. And it was a ground ball to the pitcher. Ground ball stabbed by Folk. He underhands to first, and the Red Sox are the world championship. For the first time in 86 years, the Red Sox have won baseball's world championship. Can you believe it? And can you believe it? So I guess sort of became my catchphrase. I think I used it before. I don't really know when it started. I do recall a game where Bill Miller hit a walk-off home run off Mariano Rivera in July of that year. The same game where Jason Veritek gave A-Rod the leather sandwich. I think that sort of stuck with me. And that was a great highlight. That was a weird day because the Yankees thought the game was rained out, and our owners were going to call the game, and our players, led by Jason Veritek, went to the owners and said, "We want to play. Let's wait." And they did play, and, you know, the Red Sox were losing the whole game, and then they won in the walk-off home run in the ninth inning by Bill Miller, who owned Mariano Rivera. Later in October, game four, Dave Roberts pinch runs for Millar, steals the base, and Bill Miller drives him in with a hit off Rivera. I think he hit 450 off Mariano. I don't think anyone else can claim that. But, you know, that I thought about it, and I just had to say, let it happen. I've known broadcasters who script it, and, you know, you can stumble, and it may not be appropriate. It may not fit the action. So you really just have to let it play because that's the great thing about what we do. We don't know what's going to happen.
Kevin, you have your catchphrase in the can for when the Orioles win?
Yeah, it's when the Orioles won their 40th game of the year, it was also, can you believe it? I'm kidding. I don't have anything. Should I have a catchphrase, Joe? What do you think?
It has to come naturally, no. I didn't have it, and I to be very judicious in using it. I don't use it for, you know, unless it's a spectacular comeback.
Well, Kevin,
people
what
like it.
Sorry, go ahead.
People identify with it, and that's fine. They could identify with something a lot worse.
So Kevin, speaking from my current experience as a Tigers fan, it can be very, very, very difficult to follow a team that seems like it's going nowhere year after year after year. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, certainly before this year, that Orioles fans kind of felt like they were in the same boat. A lot of other teams feel that way. But your job as a broadcaster, besides reporting on the action that's going on, is also to maintain interest in the team. So, you know, what's your approach in that situation to help keep people engaged in the game as you're going along, even as the team does not seem to be moving toward their goal of winning championships?
Luckily or unluckily, I had a lot of experience with this because in AAA in Syracuse, we in 2014, we had the best team in the International League. We won the North Division for the first time in 25 years. It was a thrill. The other 6 years, I think we were eliminated by like May 16th. Mm-hmm. So I called a lot of very bad AAA baseball. It's more fun now. No doubt it's more fun now. I know all of you who are Orioles fans here agree and understand. It is way, way more fun now and going to get even more fun. But there's always something is what I'd say. You know, if the Orioles are losing 8-1 in the seventh inning and they bring in a reliever for his third career game, well, there's going to be something interesting there. We have barely gotten to know this guy. He's only pitched in two games. Maybe he just started working on a new changeup grip this year. So I have the absolute pleasure to sit next to either Jim Palmer, who is in the Hall of Fame and a literal savant, or Ben McDonald, who was the number one pick and pitched 9 years in the big leagues and is incredibly well connected. And I can just bounce pitching off them. It's almost a cheat. I almost don't have to do anything but say, tell me about this grip. Tell me about this windup. You know, Ben will say, oh, I like this pitch sequence. Okay, why? There's always something on an individual level going on is what I felt. And, you know, if the Orioles were losing late in the game in recent years, those at-bats were still important at-bats. the players on the team the last few years have been fighting to stay in the big leagues. And so maybe it was a 7-2 game, but if Ramon Urias hit a home run, it's really important for Ramon Urias. He's trying to win a job next year. And why is it important for him? And what is his story? And how has his season changed? And how has his swing changed? So I always feel like there's something at an individual level to find, to even if the game is a blowout, try to get granular. Why is this inning important for, you know, the last couple of years, Dylan Tate? What is he working on? And maybe it didn't happen overnight, but now this year Dylan Tate's one of the better relievers in the division and has found that consistency and has found that form. And maybe we saw him work through that in, you know, 7-1 games in May of 2021. So I think all those pieces add up, but I always try to find something on an individual level. Failing that, we have a really great TV crew, and our camera operators are fantastic. And sometimes in an 11-0 game, they just find a shot of a kid with cotton candy all over his face. And we talk about that for 5 minutes, too.
So now that the Orioles are winning a little more, do you find your approach has changed at all, or do you think it's pretty much the same as it's been?
It's the same and it's different. I mean, there are always going to be games that aren't as interesting, but there's a larger narrative story now, for sure. Mm-hmm. And in the past couple of years, the larger narrative story was, you know, the individual young players, but also the draft and the minor league system. And now that stuff has moved to the back burner a little bit because the games are so interesting. Mm-hmm. So it's different because everything is a little bit more magnified now, I think. And it sometimes it's more fun to do a blowout game one way or another because that's where, you know, you and your partner can really mess around and your personalities can shine. Like the other night it was 8-2 at Tampa, and Ben told a story about how he and his dad picked out a hornet's nest in the winter. Ben McDonald, those of you who don't know, is from Louisiana. Those of you who've watched Ben know he's from Louisiana because he speaks very much like he's from Louisiana. And he and his dad went out when Ben was a kid into the woods, and it was a winter, and they found this hornet's nest, and it was a winter, so the hornets were all dormant, and his dad said, "This would be a beautiful decoration, let's bring it to the house." And they woke up the next day, and the house was a lot warmer than the woods, and there were hundreds of hornets in the house. And, you know, only Ben can tell the story that way. But if it was 4-3 in the eighth, we probably wouldn't do that. So it can be fun when it's 8-2 sometimes, because then Ben talks about hornet's nests.
Now, TV, Ernie Harwell used to say this, TV is an announcer, is an analyst medium and a director's medium. Radio's a announcer's medium because nothing happens until we say it does.
So, Joe, there was an unusual exchange that happened in September of 2018 when you and John Sterling of the Yankees switched places for an inning during the game. Can you tell us a little bit about how that worked out?
Yeah, as soon as the Wobbin was happy because you got to say a lot more. Don't tell John. We love John.
You know we're taping this, right?
But, yeah, Susan's great. She's from Boston. She grew up a Red Sox fan. I grew up a Yankee fan, but we did switch, and Giancarlo Stanton hit a grand slam that game, and he sort of looked at Tim Neverett, I was working at the time, but he said, should I do my Giancarlo and Osei Bueno and whatever it is? And he did it. And I had to call it on the Yankee broadcast, which was a lot of fun. And it was a goal for me because I always wanted to be the Yankee broadcaster when I was a kid. But that night we clinched the division against the Yankees.
So great.
We had the last laugh. We're going to do it again this year, I think.
Against the Yankees?
Against the Yankees, right. Oh, yeah. Well, not to clinch the division. I think they've got that sewed up. But we'll do the exchange because they can sell it. We have a great sponsor, and every winter I go to the Hebrew Home in Riverdale, New York, right outside the Bronx, overlooking the Hudson. And we do a program, John Sterling, myself, and Susan Waldman, for the residents there. And WFAN carries it. And the chief operating officer of the Hebrew Home is a Red Sox fan, so he buys time on our games as well as the Yankees, and that's why he gets us together, and we have this exchange. So it helps the bottom line, too, for both WFAN and our network.
Do you want to do the third inning on Masson tonight? I'll jump in with Will.
Yeah, all right, that'd be fun. I always wanted to be with the Orioles because of my association with Bill O'Donnell and Chuck Thompson. But they have a great franchise here, and I really hope it comes back. They probably need some changes very high up, but like several teams do. We just came from Pittsburgh.
Oh, boy.
Where the kids are wearing T-shirts saying, sell the team.
And who can blame them?
We went to the Roberto Clemente Museum. And we had about 30 people that went because our manager's from Puerto Rico, Alex Cora, and we took all the staff, the training staff, the coaches. Several players went. I had been 8 years before, and it's a wonderful take honoring the great one, Roberto Clemente, whom I interviewed when I worked in Youngstown, Ohio, because we were near Pittsburgh, and he was a very stoic, wonderful guy, a great humanitarian. You all know about how his life ended. And to see baseball players relate with the history and come to appreciate the man as well as the great player that he was is very heartwarming. You have to make an appointment to go. It's not open. It's in a firehouse, and they actually make wine in the basement. The Yankees went on an off night, so they had wine and pizza. We went on the morning of a game, so it wasn't quite the same. But it's a wonderful experience if you get to Pittsburgh and can go on the website and make an appointment to see the Clemente Museum. We also took a big group to the Negro League Museum, as I do every year in Kansas City. I don't know if you've ever had a Sabre convention there, but it is wonderful. The president, Bob Kendrick, gives a fantastic tour. He's a protege of Buck O'Neill, and they're trying to raise funds now for the Buck O'Neill Learning Center and the Paseo YMCA, where the Negro League started. There's a campaign on the Internet called Thanks a Million Buck, where they want a million people to give a dollar to get this thing going. But there's some great things to do on the road, and I'm sure many of you would love to do things like that.
So, you know, most booths, TV booths, Kevin, are two-man booths, but sometimes there are three-man booths. And I remember when the Tigers tried that when I was a kid, it was a disaster. They kept running into each other, and they finally abandoned that idea. But you've done both two-announcer and three-announcer booths, right?
I've done some, yeah. You probably have done a lot more than me. And actually, I'm curious how three-man on radio goes. But we had a few games with both Jim and Ben this year, which were my favorite games of the year because I just didn't have to talk for like five-minute stretches. So, I mean, Jim and Ben are the best, and they play off each other really well. It's an interesting booth because they're both pitchers. Normally, the three-man booth you see is pitcher-hitter, mm-hmm. Keith Hernandez and Ron Darling, notably with the Mets. Or David Cohn and Paul O'Neill with the Yankees. And, yeah, Jim and Ben both pitched but have such deep knowledges of the game. And Jim was a good hitter for pitcher, too. And Ben's a terrific athlete. So they played off each other well. They were able to talk both sides of the game. And Jim, maybe the best thing, and there are a lot of great things about Jim Palmer, maybe the best thing is he is so inviting and welcoming. And he'll say often on air, you know, well, Kevin, as you know, you read this article in the Boston Globe. And I'll think, I didn't actually read that article in the Boston Globe. But thank you.
You know, that's his good side.
As you know, there's a count to throw a slider. I didn't know that. I didn't win 268 games of the big leagues. But he makes you feel like you do. And that's why Jim is wonderful. And so he's so warm and he invites Ben into the conversation so well, and it's egoless, really. Mm-hmm. So I hope we do more of those, but you've probably done a lot more with Will and Lou or whoever and Lou on radio.
Yeah, we've done with Will and Lou, and when you have a player, you get a different perspective. Our TV did it very well with the late Jerry Remy and Dennis Eckersley. They really meshed together with Dave O'Brien, and I think they have a few games this year, but it's not quite the same without Jerry and the Eck together, because they just meshed so well. They were teammates, different perspectives. The Eck is retiring, which is sad to me because he's one of the great analysts ever, and he's the most honest guy you'd ever meet. He'd tell you exactly what's on his mind. Has a language all his own. Mm-hmm. He got a little heat the other day because we were playing the Pirates, and his line was, the Pirates are a hodgepodge of nothingness. Some of the players took offense to that, but he was right. Of course, they beat us last night. The only guy that could beat us at 2-2 run homers, Brian Reynolds, and we should have swept, but especially in the position we're in. But three-man booths, I think, it can be an advantage. Probably a little harder on radio because, you know, we still have to describe the play.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay, so it's 4:51 now, so I think we might have time for maybe two, maybe three questions from the audience. So let's go. You. Thoughts on Vin Scully?
Well, he was an amazing gentleman and a true gentleman. The best storyteller I've ever heard. I mean, he could spin a yarn, and, of course, he experienced this so much in 67 years in the broadcast booth. And he was so gracious, and he had an elegant style, really. And he was a very well-read guy. But very much a gentleman and very kind and giving to young broadcasters. We were at Dodger Stadium 5 or 6 years ago, and they announced that Vince would come back for his 65th season on Dodger baseball. So I went in his booth to congratulate him. At the time, I had 31 years of the Red Sox. And I said, Vince, congratulations, 65 years, amazing. And he said, oh, you can do it too. And I did the math. I would be 97.
Okay.
My question is, from a broadcasting perspective, which major league ballpark is the hardest for you to broadcast from based on where you're sitting and broadcasting the game? Like, I know PNC Park is, like, really, really high. Is just the height alone, does that go into your factor, or I don't know.
I was going to say PNC and Nationals Park.
Nationals Park.
Everyone's like a little tiny ant there. My first big league game was at PNC, and I just took 20 minutes to just sit there. This is when I was filling up for the Nationals. I took 20 minutes to just sit there and watch batting practice because I wanted to get a sense for how the flight of the ball looked from up there, especially in the minors where you're so low. It is a challenge.
At PNC, you're recessed as well as being high. Washington is the toughest I've been in because every pop foul looks like a home run because I think we're 10 stories up there. I've not been to the Texas ballpark yet, the new one, but I understand that might be number one in terms of degree of difficulty.
Yeah. Thank you.
You know, some of these owners sell the seats where we used to be. Yeah, move us up.
My question is for Kevin. From what I enjoy listening to you, I think you're doing a great job. I would love to know why the radio team on the radio side cannot travel. Wonder what the deal is there. And the second one is just an easy question. What's your favorite city to go to, you know, to travel to?
Number one, I genuinely do not know. Someone else besides me would be able to answer that probably. I hope they'll be out soon. Favorite road city to go to? Wow. You know, I don't know if this is my favorite, but it's the one that jumps out right now. I went to Minneapolis for the first time this year and absolutely loved it. Target Field was instantly one of my favorite parks. Loved the design, loved the feel of it, loved the booth location, had some of the best food I've ever eaten in Minneapolis. If you go to Minneapolis, go to Bar La Grassa, have the orange cauliflower gnocchi. It's out of this world.
Best media dining room, too, by far.
Really good media dining.
which matters a lot for us. Yeah. Favorite road cities. Where is the media food good? And Minneapolis is great.
I hope they have crab cakes tonight.
Not likely, I'd say. I'll get you a crab cake, but not in the press room. Yeah.
I was wondering if you have any thoughts on what the future of broadcasting is. Radio seems pretty set as long as the teams keep supporting it, but television's all over the place anymore. You get games on Apple TV, and that's the only place you can watch it. So are we going to go streaming on television?
I think it's probably going to stay segmented and keep getting more segmented. I am curious when the bubble bursts, just because the streaming wars right now, not everybody's going to survive them. Like Netflix is hemorrhaging subscribers, and HBO and Discovery are combining. So I don't know that this is going to happen forever, but the Big Ten media deal that just came out, I mean, the Big Ten's now going to be in Fox, CBS, NBC, FS1, Peacock, probably somewhere down the line there'll be with Amazon or Apple or, you know, Peacock Minus or Peacock 8.
Yeah.
I think at least for a few more years, I don't know, I'm not smart enough to know if all of these streaming sites are going to continue, but it's the easiest way to gain credibility. Like if you're a nascent streaming service, if you're Peacock and you want people to watch more than just reruns of The Office, you know, you pick up Major League Baseball, you pick up Big Ten football, and people will subscribe, I think.
That's why the owners make so much before they sell a ticket.
Okay, it's 4:57, so one more.
My house, my triple decker, is 1 mile from Fenway Park's home plate. I had season tickets to the Red Sox for 30 years. I got $20 here that says everybody in this room, when we finally knew we were going to be here this week, thought that we were going to see a decent team and a clown team, but we got the teams mixed up.
I like this guy.
We're still alive.
You've been officially upstaged.
My question 59 is, and how 60. Have you both felt about announcing the last 2 months of the season from your perspectives?
You want to start?
Well, we hope we become a little bit more competitive. I mean, we're seventh. There are three wild card spots, and we're seventh, 5 games behind the third wild card. We still think we can go on a run. We have still have a high payroll. I don't know if any team has paid the luxury tax and not finished last, but I think we're due for a run. We're getting guys back healthy. We haven't hit like we thought we would. We thought we'd score more runs, but I think it still can happen when we get players back healthy. We got Michael Walker back. He spun a beauty against the Yankees last Sunday. He's going to pitch in this series. I don't think we're going to get Chris. We're not going to get Chris Sale back this year, but I think we still have enough to make a run, and that's the hope. So, but there are a lot of teams to climb over.
For me, I mean, I've only been doing this for 4 years here and 11 years professionally. It's certainly the most fun I've had. It's fun not only because the team is winning, but it's the way in which they're winning. I think maybe 25 out of the Orioles' 61 wins have been comeback wins, something like that. So whereas in years past it was 3-0, you know, Boston or Tampa or Toronto in the eighth inning and you know, the game was just over. Now they seem to rally, and even if they don't take the lead, they'll bring the tying run to the plate. So even the losses have been more exciting. It's been way more exciting for me than our manager, who has no hair left and yet is still tearing it out because every game we play is a 2-run or 1-run game. But it's been a thrilling brand of baseball. If they were winning every game, you know, 6-2, it would still be exciting. But to have all of these comebacks, all of these close games, and the fact that it was so unexpected. I mean, we have the luckiest job in the world. We get to get paid to talk about baseball. That's insane. How? But even if the team won 20 games, it would still be an astonishingly wonderful job. But to have it happen in a year where nothing was expected, I think just makes it sweeter.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, one more time for Kevin Brown and Joe Castiglione.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody.